From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The war on AIDS is more important than the war on terrorism. Just any way you measure this global threat, it is. But because the epicenter is in Africa, the U.S. doesn't give it the urgency it deserves. But it is indeed the greatest threat to African survival in many parts of the enormous continent.
Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and U2 rock star Bono's unprecedented joint Africa tour has drawn to a close. We'll look at the politics of the tour. But first, an Enron-like scandal threatens to erupt at Halliburton, where Dick Cheney was chief executive. And as Pakistan and India draw closer to the brink of war, we'll speak with the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi on building a legacy of nonviolence. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, the new director of the Israel Broadcast Authority, Yosef Barel. Thursday banned the use of the term settlers from the airwaves. The instructions to editors came after the Environmental Affairs Minister told Barel he should put an end to the frequent use of the term settler on radio and TV broadcasts. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting that Israel has laid the foundations for some 40 new settlements in the past few months alone. Israeli troops and tanks raided the West Bank city of Nablus and the nearby refugee camp of Balata early this morning. Soldiers went from house to house in the camp by breaking through walls. Israel Radio reported the army has taken up observation posts inside Palestinian apartments, forcing some families into one room. An armed Palestinian infiltrated a settlement north of Nablus and was killed by a settler. And CIA Director George Tenet embarks today on a secret visit to the region to try to rebuild Palestinian security forces that were mauled during Israel's recent invasion of the West Bank. U.S. forces released 50 Afghan villagers and the body of their 100-year-old tribal leader Thursday after 6 days of imprisonment. U.S. troops killed the elder and took 55 men in a nighttime raid on the village last week. Military officials say the village was a suspected sanctuary of Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces, but the mass release appears to show most were found to have no such connections. The raid and killing of their leader enraged the villagers. They traveled to Kandahar to protest to the governor. U.S. forces offered to hand over the body of the leader, but the villagers refused to take it until the prisoners were released as well. Pakistan withdrew troops from the Afghan border today, possibly to move them to the Kashmir frontier for a face-off with India. Meanwhile, President Bush announced Thursday he'll send War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to India and Pakistan next week to deal with the escalating situation. The British Chief of Defense Staff admitted during a visit to Bagram Air Base that the crisis is hitting U.S. operations on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The European Parliament Thursday bowed to pressure from individual governments led by Britain and voted to give European law enforcement agencies the power to access the communications records of every phone and internet user. Governments will be able to force phone and internet companies to keep detailed logs of their customers' communications for an unspecified period. Currently, records are kept only for a couple of months for billing purposes before being destroyed. Police will also be able to map people's precise movements from cell phone records because the phones communicate with the nearest base station every few seconds. The legislation was denounced by civil liberties groups worldwide who say the move amounts to blanket surveillance of the whole population. Meanwhile, Britain announced a tightening of its immigration laws Thursday. It will now forbid rejected asylum seekers from launching an appeal within the country. And Australia says it will pay asylum seekers over $1,000 each to return home. California officials are angry at what they're describing as President Bush's highly political decision to buy out oil drilling leases in Florida, but not California. In Washington on Wednesday, President Bush sat next to his brother Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, and vowed to spend over $200 million of federal money to buy highly unpopular oil leases in a state where his brother's running for re-election. But Californians have bitterly opposed offshore drilling since a disastrous oil spill off the California coast in 1969. Officials from the heavily Democratic state have urged the federal government to stop drilling. But when many of the oil company leases were set to expire, the Bush administration extended them. The state and environmental groups sued and won in federal court, but the Bush administration appealed. Oral arguments will begin in San Francisco in a few days. And the cleanup at New York's Ground Zero has officially ended. Thousands of people watched Thursday as an empty stretcher symbolizing the dead who will never be found was carried out of the pit. Then a truck carted away the last steel column from the World Trade Center site.
Some folks are born made to wave a flag, yeah, the red, white, and blue. When the band plays Hail to the Chief, yeah, they pull the cannon at you.
Fortunate Son by U2. We'll be talking about the tour that Bono took with Paul O'Neill, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, through Africa, coming up on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And welcome to our listeners, Amy, around the country.
It's good to have you with us, or actually it's great to be back here in New York after the trip to East Timor. Also a sad day yesterday with the World Trade Center site, with the end of the official end of the recovery period after 8.5 months. You've done a lot of important work around the environmental issues at Ground Zero.
Yes, and they're going to continue. There have been a series of protests actually occurring. And now even among those, the residents of some of the poorer communities, Chinatown and the Lower East Side, that have gotten very little attention, are beginning to become organized and demand attention and resources from the government to deal with the aftermath.
And that's where we are right now, actually, right now in Chinatown at the at Downtown Community Television, where we broadcast from. Well, we're going to look at another scandal right now. An Enron-like accounting scandal is threatening to erupt around Halliburton, the multi-billion-dollar oil company that Vice President Dick Cheney used to run. It emerged this week that the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating Halliburton's accounting methods while Cheney was its chief executive. Halliburton adopted new accounting methods in 1998, which allowed it to hide possible losses of hundreds of millions of dollars. Halliburton didn't tell its investors of the change for more than a year. The company's auditor, Arthur Andersen, gave Halliburton the green light. Halliburton's the world's largest oil services company, with more than $13 billion in annual revenues. Cheney made a fortune off of Halliburton, raking in more than $30 million in stock options alone. Wall Street analysts have praised him for turning the company into a global giant with soaring revenues and business in more than 130 countries. But Halliburton has also come under heavy criticism. It's consistently used its government connections to win lucrative contracts, and it's well known for its ties to countries with brutal military regimes like Burma, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria. It also signed contracts with Iraq worth more than $73 million while Cheney was at the helm, this despite his adamant support for sanctions against Iraq. Well, we're going to go to Berkeley right now to Prothap Chatterjee, who is a freelance journalist and did a very interesting piece in the Bay Guardian that was called "The War on Terrorism's Gravy Train: Cheney's Former Company Wins Afghanistan War Contracts." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Prothap.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, first off, can you talk about this latest scandal?
Well, the latest scandal is basically about the fact that Halliburton has been taking the cost overruns at its construction projects and booking them as revenue, even though customers have said that they won't necessarily pay the bills. So, for example, let's say Halliburton was given a contract to build a natural gas plant in Brazil, shall we say. And they said they would do it for $100 million, but then it actually cost $150 million. And then the person who purchased the natural gas plant said, well, we won't pay you that extra $50 million. Halliburton basically put this money in its profits, and 50% of its profits actually represent these bills that people had said they wouldn't necessarily pay. Eventually, most of these customers did pay these bills, but the SEC is upset because they say that Halliburton is trying to report profits that it wouldn't necessarily get, and they say that that's, you know, not a good accounting practice. A little like Enron booking profits that they didn't necessarily make, but simply by buying and selling energy and that kind of thing back to itself. So this is the latest scandal. However, Halliburton has a history of cost overruns in a lot of projects, and not just for natural gas projects, but also in its contracts for the military and everybody else. And this is not to say that that's not true of, that's just true of Halliburton, but most any construction company runs over budget and then builds its customers. And, you know, there's often a lot of disputes as to whether or not the client will pay that kind of cost.
Well, Perthap, in terms of this particular scandal, there's some indications that the company was already suffering in terms of its stock price as investors found out about the because clearly when investors don't know about a major issue affecting the revenue of a company, they get upset, right? So there's been a do you see this SEC inquiry as possibly expanding and creating significant problems or deeper investigations?
It's possible. I mean, I know that when the Enron scandal happened, I've been writing about Enron for 7 years, looking at the environmental problems, the human rights abuses, but also their political payments out to politicians such as George Bush. And so when the SEC and people started saying that they would look into Enron's accounting practices, you know, I thought, nothing's going to come of that. And it was, within a month, you know, the company had collapsed. It was amazing. Perhaps that will happen with Halliburton. Right now, I don't think so, but it's not impossible that we could be looking at it. With Enron, there was no way anybody who hadn't actually the inside track to know that the company was actually, you know, operating in completely falsely created accounting and energy trading schemes. I mean, it was just impossible to know. Perhaps that happened at Halliburton. I think the bigger issue, both at Enron and Halliburton, not to say that accounting fraud and that kind of thing are good things, but it is the larger issue of, you know, who they're working for, the kind of customers, the kind of practices they have, and what they're doing. And in the case of Halliburton, they're really involved in the quote-unquote war on terrorism. Some of the people whom they're overbilling are the U.S. taxpayer. So just to give you an example, back in 1996, as a part of a contract to support the U.S. military in Bosnia, they told Congress that they would a particular operation cost $191.6 million. And so what they often did, and this is probably true of a lot of companies, is they underbid. They went to the client, in this case the taxpayer, and said, we're going to, you know, it's going to cost us $191.6 million to support the military in Hungary. But then when the actual bill was to be paid, it turned out it was, in this particular case, $461.5 million, which is, you know, more than twice the original bill. Now, of course, the taxpayer pays up because there's not much else. The accountability is often lacking. Private contractors might actually take a much harder look at this. But this is how Halliburton has made a lot of its profits. They'll turn around, tell a client that they'll be able to do it a lot cheaper. And then they'll go ahead and do the contract, and then they'll present them with the bill and say, well, this is actually what it cost, and the clan then has to pay the bill. There was a case here in Monterey in California.
If I can interrupt for 1 second talk a little bit about in your recent article about Halliburton's involvement with defense contracts related to the war in Afghanistan, and you talk specifically about how, in classic style, this is a company that is directly benefiting from the military effort in Afghanistan.
Oh, absolutely. Right now, as we speak, there's a base in central Uzbekistan called Khanabad, near the town of Karshi, and this is one of the major bases from which the war in Afghanistan was launched. And as we speak, there are something like 38 Halliburton Brown & Root, is the subsidiary that does this, Kellogg Brown & Root, based in Uzbekistan. They're about to, as of 10 days from now, they will take over the running of the base. And when I say the running of the base, I don't mean, you know, running military operations, or running support operations. So it's the laundries, the tents, the messes, that kind of thing. And this is what they did in Bosnia. This is what they did in Somalia. This is what they did in Haiti. And to a small extent, they did in East Timor. It was DynCorp that did the operation in East Timor. But basically, military contractors for the last 10 years have provided a lot of what you might think of as MASH duties, quartermaster duties, where they come in and run in things that you don't need specialized soldiers, that don't involve, you know, military operations. And so they're now talking about them taking over the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Another thing they're doing is the prisons in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Those are being built currently, they're almost done, by Brown & Root. The embassy in Uzbekistan and Albania, the security for that, is being reinforced by Brown & Root. So they're making hundreds of millions of dollars going in and becoming part of the war on terrorism. Separately, they also have contracts to demilitarize, to get rid of missiles in the former Soviet Union. So they're making a lot of money, and a lot of this started under Cheney's watch from the military's privatization of ancillary operations, so to speak.
Now, is it just a coincidence that they happen to be getting all of these contracts? Was there any competitive bidding process that went on, or any indication of how it is that they've sort of cornered the market or the field in this area, the vice president's former company?
This is a good question, and I've talked to a lot of people in the military, and they've assured me that there was competitive bidding, but they won't tell me who the other competitors were. They said, you know, it's secret. So, they assure me that Dick Cheney had nothing to do with it. I spoke to the man who's in charge of the contract, Mike Knoll, in Virginia, and he assures me, I said, well, is it a coincidence that your vice president for government operations happens to be an admiral who happened to be the chief of Southern Forces Europe for the U.S. Army? And he said, and before you ask, let me tell you, Dick Cheney had nothing to do with our contract, getting this contract to work in Uzbekistan and places like that. So a little sensitive to this. And they claim that this is not true at all. But the fact of the matter is that in 1992, Dick Cheney commissioned Brown & Root to study how to privatize these ancillary operations of the U.S. Army. And they came back with results and said, this is how we can do it. And, of course, they got the first contract. This is the third contract that's been awarded. I mean, and it's always... Some of the contracts have gone to a rival company called DynCorp, and by and large, Brown & Root created the idea of privatizing the military and drew up the plans under Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense in the U.S. Army, and now they're getting all the major contracts. So,
Prothap, you spent time in Uzbekistan, and these bases that are now ringing Afghanistan through the stands are hardly getting any attention, the U.S. bases that are being built all over the area.
The bases, for example, in Khanabad, I try to get into the base, but they wouldn't let me in for some unknown reason. They're highly secret in many ways. You have, 1,500 U.S. soldiers, and they're placed in areas that, are away from the public. And this is, we're talking about, in also away from the scrutiny of, of human rights observers, because a lot of these, in Uzbekistan, for example, there's a tremendous human rights issue where the government cracks down on anybody that they call an Islamic fundamentalist. And I went to trials in Uzbekistan of, you know, school teachers who were illiterate, who were claimed to be, you know, fundamentalists, who could barely even read and they were accused of passing out pamphlets. So country of Uzbekistan, there's 7,000 political prisoners, allegedly Muslim fundamentalists. And this crackdown is happening especially in the borders of the camps. So in Khanabad, for example, you know, people, you know, are not allowed to have any overseas guests. If remotely they're, you know, found in violation of anything, they're swept into prison, because the last thing the Uzbekistan government wants to do is have any kind of problem outside the U.S. base. So we're talking about an increase in human rights abuses simply because of these bases.
We have been talking to Prothap Chatterjee. He has a piece in the Bay Guardian and at corpwatch.org called "The War on Terrorism's Gravy Train, Cheney's Former Company Wins Afghanistan War Contracts," about Halliburton. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, Arun Gandhi. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. The threat of war between nuclear-armed Pakistan and India is increasing. Pakistan withdrew troops from the Afghan border today, possibly to move them to the Kashmir frontier for a face-off with India. Militants attacked more police posts in Kashmir, and heavy cross-border shelling, mortar, and gunfire continued. The Indian Prime Minister has told Indian troops in Kashmir to prepare for sacrifices and decisive victory. It seems plausible India is preparing for a limited war to flush out Islamic militant camps in Pakistan-administered Kashmir, but Pakistan has vowed to retaliate if attacked, possibly with nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, President Bush announced on Thursday he's sending War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to the region next week. Pakistani physicist and writer Pervez Hoodboy argues that the conflict will extend far beyond Kashmir. He writes, even more important than the fate of a few million Kashmiris is that of India's huge Muslim minority, which equals or exceeds the population of Pakistan. Without Pakistan's decisive action on cross-border insurgency, the Muslims of India will become the target of state-sponsored pogroms and ethnic cleansing. The massacres of Gujarat provide a chilling preview of what may lie ahead at the hands of a fundamental Hindu government. Today we're joined by a well-known nonviolence advocate, teacher, and writer, Arun Gandhi. He's the grandson of the great independence leader and nonviolence activist Mahatma Gandhi, who in fact was born in Gujarat. After the religious killings there, Arun Gandhi wrote, "Never have I been so ashamed to be recognized as a Hindu as I am today after the horrendous killings and savagery of Hindus in Gujarat state." Arun Gandhi has devoted his life to building on the legacy of nonviolence of Mahatma Gandhi. He's the co-founder and director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee, and in 1960 founded the Center for Social Unity, an economic self-help program for untouchable caste in India. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Can we start off by talking about what's happening now between India and Pakistan and also the issue of the horrible Gujarati killings?
Yes, it's very unfortunate what's happening right now. It's a tragedy. It's something that we don't need at this time at all. But this has been going on for 50 years, off and on. It gets hot and cold all the time. And the only solution for this is, in my opinion, to put the politicians away somewhere, lock them up in a cupboard and let the people decide what they want to do. And I think the people on both sides want peace, and they want to live in peace and harmony. It's the politicians who exploit them and create this kind of conflict and lead us to the brink of war there.
Well, interestingly, I've been reading recently the book by the Pakistani Marxist Tariq Ali, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, where he talks about not only the rise of fundamentalism throughout much of the Middle East, but also the role of the old colonial powers in actually fomenting or supporting the rise of fundamentalism as a means in the 50s and 60s of attempting to stop the forces of modernization or Marxist or left forces within the Muslim and the Middle Eastern world, and that has now come back to haunt the West. This support by the British and the Americans of groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or of the jihad warriors in Afghanistan or in other parts of the Middle East.
Yes, I think, you know, we are paying, the world is paying the price for colonialism and all the other, you know, first we had the political colonialism of the British, and then we had the economic colonialism in which almost the entire West has gotten involved in it. And we have always, because of our colonial interests, supported the wrong groups of people. We have encouraged the wrong kinds of people and created situations. I mean, Ireland was divided by Britain. India and Pakistan was divided by Britain. Israel and Palestine have been divided by Britain. And the rightist conservatives even tried to divide South Africa when they became independent. And all of these divisions is part of the whole philosophy of divide and rule. That the more you can divide the other part of the world and control them, the better control you have over them.
What do you think has been the impact on Indian society in recent years of the coming to power of such a conservative, nationalistic, and right-wing group in the Indian government?
Well, everybody is very unhappy about it, you know, and they have come in through the back door because fundamentalism has been on the rise, as you said earlier, all over the world, and so it was part of the whole, you know, atmosphere that the Indians also voted in a fundamentalist party. Although it's a coalition, it's not, they don't have a clear majority or anything, but it's a coalition of several parties that is trying to give India stability there. But it's very unfortunate that India should get to this point, and I hope that in the next elections that we would come back again to a more secular party and a more secular politics.
How much of Gandhi's legacy is remembered and maybe more importantly honored in India right now?
I think a lot of it. I think there are many people in the grassroots level, people who are working and doing wonderful work. I think Gandhi is revered very much by the common people in India, as everywhere else. But Gandhi does not exist in the political circles and politicians. He was never there when India became independent. The government had abandoned Gandhi's philosophy altogether. They had sort of decided they were not going to have anything to do with him or his philosophy. So at the political and the official level, Gandhi was forgotten, you know, way back in 1946, 47, even before India became independent. But at the common level, I must say that he is still very much revered.
And You talk quite a bit about the changes in Indian in your writings about the changes of Indian society, especially in terms of how the society and the government are dealing both with the Muslim minority within the nation as well as with the untouchables. And can you talk a little bit about how, in the context of all of this violence and the recent religious pogroms that are occurring in the country, how you see a way out now in India and also in terms of the India-Pakistan dispute?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, we have to go back into the history of all of this. And I think when India became independent in 1947, we adopted a secular constitution, and the Congress Party that came into power tried to implement the secular philosophy of the party there. But I think they misunderstood and misconstrued the concept of secularism, with the result that they started giving the Muslims greater privileges than other people, and creating that kind of imbalance. They also indulged in communal politics. They would create vote banks of Muslims and of the low caste people and so on, and exploit one and against the other. And now we are paying the price for it. You see, the nation has reached a point when they are saying, why aren't we all equal? Why do we need to have different laws governing different people? Why can't all Indians be treated as equal under one law there? And this is something that nobody has ever done and nobody intends to do still. So as long as we have these kinds of differences and different laws and different lifestyles governing different people, we are going to have conflicts all the time. And I don't think that's what secularism was supposed to be. Secularism was that everybody is equal, everybody is Indian, and everybody is governed by one law.
We're talking to Arun Gandhi, who is a leader of nonviolence himself in Memphis, Tennessee, and is also the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. How would you apply the philosophy in the occupied territories between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Well, I think we need to remember that nonviolence is not a strategy. It's not something that we can use today and discard tomorrow. It's a way of life. We have to make it a part of our attitudes. We have to internalize nonviolence, and that means we have to create a culture of nonviolence. Today we have a culture of violence, and a culture of violence evokes all the negative aspects in us, and that negative aspect is selfishness and greed and self-centeredness and exploitation and all of these negative things that we see in our societies today comes out of the culture of violence. If we have a culture of non-violence, then we will have positive aspects coming out, where relationships between people would be based on respect and understanding of each other and not selfishly motivated. And when we have respect and understanding between individuals, we eliminate conflict automatically.
In terms of the issue of nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war, now it's so ironic that a nation that was led to independence by a leader of nonviolence should now be possibly at the brink of a nuclear holocaust between itself and in Pakistan. What has been the role of this drive for the development of nuclear weapons in terms of the impact on Indian society and on Pakistani society?
I think what led India into developing a nuclear weapon, and in some ways I think the West has played a very important role in this, especially the United States. And let me explain this. In 1947, when India became independent, it adopted a democratic constitution because it valued human rights. It respect the democracy and the liberalism that goes with it. And it hoped that it would evoke some positive response from the West, especially the United States, and that the United States would appreciate this and help them overcome all their problems, economic problems, with aid and help of whatever nature. But instead, today they found that the image of India in the West was one of a economically distressed country, and poverty and destitution and all that. And yet, at the same time, you had China that flouted all democratic principles, went the communist way, which the United States abhorred all the time. We were told that communism is evil and we should have nothing to do with it. But when they developed nuclear weapons, we could do nothing about it, and made some feeble protests and did nothing about it. They are respected. China is respected. China is on the Security Council. It is one of the five nations that has the veto power. It is highly respected. The image today in the common man in the streets of the West is that China is a very rapidly advancing, wonderful country, and yet they also have the same problems as India has. Mm. So when you treat two countries in the same situation, treat them differently, you're going to have some reaction. Mm. And so Indian politicians concluded that if we can gain respect of the West by flouting their principles, then why not do that?
Yeah. Finally, in the couple of minutes that we have left, I'd be interested if I'm sure you've at times speculated or wondered about this. Had your grandfather lived with the situation been able to have more impact on the development of India through the period of independence, would things have been different, you think, in India?
I think they would be very, very different. I mean, I'm sure there would be greater morality and principles in politics in India. India would have been a very different country. It may not have been economically very advanced. We wouldn't have perhaps all the nuclear weapons and all of the other big factories and dams that we have, but India would have been a much saner, much more peaceful, and a much more united country, and he would have even helped resolve this whole issue between India and Pakistan, and we would have been living peacefully together there.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with Arun Gandhi, who is the co-founder and director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. You've been listening to Democracy Now! We're going to take a break now, and when we return, we're going to go to an interview that Amy did yesterday at the end of the so-called African tour of U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Irish rocker Bono. We'll be back in a minute.
Tole
U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and rock star Bono of U2 have wound up their highly publicized Africa tour. At a briefing with reporters, O'Neill said the two bonded in believing a better life is possible for the impoverished sub-Saharan region. The idea of a joint trip was hatched a year ago when the two men met in O'Neill's office. O'Neill was initially reluctant to meet with Bono, but said later he was impressed by the singer's knowledge of Africa's problems. They decided to take a trip together to try to learn what kind of aid really works. But the two have been fighting throughout the trip. Earlier this week, O'Neill suggested the public in the U.S. and Britain should be encouraged to think in terms of donating Dr. Seuss books to Ugandan schools, quote, in effect adopting a child. He said we need to make this into individual people things, not some cosmic stuff about billions of dollars. Bono retorted, it takes billions of dollars. It's not cosmic for these kids to have a cup of porridge a day. Bono's also upset about a farm bill President Bush recently signed. The $190 billion bill doles out an 80% increase in subsidies to American farmers. Critics from the U.S. to Ghana to South Africa say those subsidies will put millions of small farmers out of business in Africa and jeopardize the continent's efforts to overcome poverty. We're joined right now by two people. Mark Ritchie is the president of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And Sally Booker is Executive Director of Africa Action. Sally Booker, let's begin with you. How do you assess this trip of the U.S. Treasury Secretary with his strange bedfellow, Bono?
Well, indeed, it was a strange trip. As many people refer to it as the tour by a millionaire with a heart accompanied by a heartless billionaire, and you can guess who's who. I think, on the one hand, Bono is using his celebrity progressively to try and campaign and take the moral high ground. But most recently, and on this trip, he's been using his celebrity to gain access and attempt to influence policymakers from within, and there are certain risks of that. But the trip overall, I think, did help publicize and publicly challenge the U.S. role in Africa. There's the risk, however, the Bush administration seeks to use its association with Bono to legitimize policies that in the end are harmful to Africa, such as the Millennium Challenge account that Bush announced, where he'll increase aid levels to poor countries 2 years from now, but only in return for their agreeing to the U.S. dictation of economic and governance policies. And the other problem is, in a way, the trip to some degree plays into the racism of the U.S. government. In other words, by refusing to listen to Africa advocates here in the U.S., or especially to listen to Africans directly, the U.S. government requires some sort of white interlocutor to take them on a trip in Africa. And that's not a swipe at Bono, but it is a inherent problem in the American approach to Africa.
Mark Ritchie, your response to this trip?
Well, I was happy to see that the press did discover that there was a large continent called Africa and that there were very serious problems from one corner to the other. But I think it's been clear from the beginning that the differences of opinion about what should be done aren't just limited to Bono and Secretary O'Neill, but especially the grassroots organizations in Africa themselves have been very, very vocal about the problems with the neoliberal model that was being promoted in different ways by both of these people on this trip, and really demanding a new perspective and a new way to approach their problems from the grassroots up.
And the bill, how it connects, the agriculture bill that Bush just signed off on this week.
Well, it's been interesting because the reality of the bill is that it spends just about the same amount of money as we have spent over the last 5 or 6 years. So it's not a significant change in reality to what has been in practice. But the reaction globally has been very, very strong, very vocal, and I think this is an important change. The international agriculture policies are laid out primarily by the World Trade Organization. The primary objective of those policies has been to drive down the price of commodities, the price paid to farmers. The end result of this farm bill will be to drive prices a little bit lower than they are now. This will add further damage to African farmers who've been on the brink for the last decade perhaps longer, the end result will be the further elimination of food producers in Africa, the creation of more hunger, yes, but increasingly the creation of more dependency on imported food from the United States, Europe, Australia, the major exporting nations.
How does this fit in with President Bush being opposed, supposedly, to protectionism? I mean, it sounds also a little like the steel bill and protecting U.S. steel.
Highlights the hypocrisy of the United States policies and U.S. support for a sort of system of global apartheid, of double standards for the poor majority of the world, and a different set of rules for the wealthy minority in the world. As Mark pointed out, this kind of subsidizing, and it's not unique to the United States, it's true of European countries, of Canada. It's a major thing dividing rich and poor countries, and this subsidization, you know, driving down commodity prices, making it, you know, impossible for poor, unsubsidized farmers to compete. And of course, the World Bank, the IMF, rich creditor countries have been applying all kinds of pressures on African governments to end their agricultural subsidies, to open their markets. And beyond agriculture, trade barriers in general among the rich countries cost poor countries some $100 billion a year in lost revenues because they can't access those markets.
And who exactly benefits from the subsidies?
In the case of agriculture, the people who benefit from the government payments are the buyers of the crops from farmers. Most farmers are selling their crops at about half the cost of production. Most of the U.S. exports of those commodities are going out of the country at about half the cost of production. In trade terms, this is called dumping. So if you're a Coca-Cola and you're buying corn sweetener to for all your soda pop, you're benefiting from this. If you're a importer in Hamburg, Germany, or a feed grinder in Tokyo, Japan, you're benefiting from this, you know, this particular approach to agriculture policy. Whoever is buying to use or to export the commodities from farmers are getting those commodities at half the cost of production, and they are the primary beneficiaries.
We're talking to Mark Ritchie. He is the president of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, also Sally Booker, executive director of Africa Action. Sally Booker, Paul O'Neill and Bono went to Ghana, South Africa, Uganda, and Ethiopia. We cannot exactly lump these countries together. Can you talk about the significance of each when it comes to the issue of debt and agriculture?
Right. Well, they're each in slightly different categories. The trip ostensibly was going to focus on aid, development assistance. Bono challenging Secretary O'Neill to show him that aid programs do work in helping to address poverty and that there's a need to reduce debt in order to free up funds for anti-poverty efforts. To some degree, they started off on a false debate on aid, because the conventional wisdom is that aid is somehow a charitable thing to do, and that the U.S. is also very generous, which is not true, and that aid is, in fact, optional. In fact, we would argue that aid is not charity. It's a form of public investment, and it's an obligation. In the U.S. case toward Africa, it's a historic obligation. It's also a matter of responsibility for the future. And new models are needed for the provision of public investment, and that's really what they should be focused on, things like the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, a fund that the United States has refused to give very significant amounts to. O'Neill didn't want to focus on debt at all, and to his credit, Bono continued to raise the issue, because there's more money going out of Africa than there is going in. African countries are paying some $15 billion servicing old and illegitimate debts to the World Bank, the IMF, and rich creditors every year, and that's more money than they're receiving in development assistance or in direct foreign investment. In the case of Ghana, Ghana's a recent country that has qualified for the existing debt relief framework, the HIPC, the Heavily Indebted Poor Country Initiative called HIPIC. The problem with that initiative, created in 96 and revised in 99, it's designed by the creditors, the World Bank, the IMF, the rich country creditors, and it's basically designed to serve their interests, not to provide a final exit from this debt burden by the poor countries. Uganda, which was the third country on the visit, has sort of suggested to be the star pupil of the HIPIC program. But even Uganda's debt, which has received some debt relief, is now going back through the roof. Why? Because coffee prices have gone down. And that whole scheme, a bit of a shell game, was based on unrealistic projections about export earnings. South Africa has enormous apartheid-era debts, and it doesn't qualify for the HIPIC program because it's not considered poor enough. And so you have this kind of diversity, but it's really a shell game. It allows the creditors to maintain leverage over poor countries and dictate economic policies. We wish that Bono would have been a bit more forceful in pointing out the need for absolute debt cancellation, not a tinkering with the existing framework.
And Ethiopia in particular, and Ethiopia's relationship right now with Eritrea? Sally,
well, the war, sadly, between Ethiopia and Eritrea took off the hopeful feeling people had about both of those countries after Eritrea's independence and the change of regime in Ethiopia at the beginning of the 90s. And as a result of that war, as a result of both of those countries' impoverization, they have fallen under greater influence of the World Bank and the IMF, and where they were once voices for a sort of greater alternative approach, a greater self-determination, that neither of them are in a position much to challenge the creditors now because they're so dependent on both of them for financial assistance for development. But O'Neill was visiting Ethiopia because of the annual meeting of the Africa Development Bank, important regional bank, again, a regional bank that holds a lot of this unpayable debt that African countries are forced to pay back, and another part of the equation in terms of debt cancellation. But I think, again, O'Neill did not, or rather avoided addressing that while in Ethiopia.
We're talking to Sally Booker of Africa Action, Mark Ritchie, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. The other issue that they raised was AIDS and HIV, visiting hospitals and orphanages. What about the status of HIV and AIDS in Africa now?
Right. Well, you know, Africa is the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. It's the worst plague in human history, killing more people. Last year alone, some 3 million people, 2.5 million of them in Africa. I mean, the statistics are numbing for many, but it is indeed the greatest threat to Africa's survival in many parts of the enormous continent. But because the epicenter is in Africa, the U.S. doesn't give it the urgency it deserves. The war on AIDS is more important than the war on terrorism, just any way you measure this global threat, it is. O'Neill himself is widely believed to be the senior Treasury Department official who was quoted in the New York Times in April of last year saying that he wouldn't support financing for treatment of HIV/AIDS victims in Africa because Africans couldn't tell time. Another senior official in the Bush administration later said the same thing on the record and in testimony, and so the spotlight shifted away from O'Neill. But we wrote O'Neill a letter at the time demanding the identity of that senior official and a retraction, and basically we were brushed off. We don't have the access that that Bono does. But in essence, the United States is failing Africa in its most urgent priority, which is the full funding of this rather modest global fund for AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. It represents a new vehicle for delivering assistance to actually defeat the pandemic, and indeed could work, but the rich countries are refusing to pay up.
I might add that
Mark Ritchie.
The African countries have taken the lead in demanding changes in the international trade rules which make it possible to provide low-cost, often very inexpensive AIDS treatments for the rest of the world, in Brazil and other large countries who also face this pandemic. So while Africa is the center of this crisis, they're also at the forefront of the political campaign to take these drugs out of the grip of the large corporations who are charging exorbitant fees and changing the rules to make them much cheaper and affordable so that all of the planet can have a chance of surviving. And I think we need to give Africa credit for this real important political objective.
Sally Booker.
The meeting at Doha, the last WTO meeting, where the principle was again reiterated that public interest, public health take priority over patents, and that African and other poor country governments are free to import generic drugs, to engage in compulsory licensing, to produce cheaper generic versions of antiretrovirals or other essential medicines themselves. South Africa forced the pharmaceutical companies to back down on a major lawsuit last year. And so I agree with Mark. This is incredible progress in the interest of the whole world. Yet at the same time, people are dying because less than 1% of the HIV/AIDS positive people in Africa have access to these sort of, these types of medicines. They've won, in a way, the legal battle, but these companies and the governments that protect their interests continue to lean on African governments to make sure that they're not actually carrying forward with their rights. So, for example, in South Africa, since they forced Big Pharma to back down, they still nevertheless have not yet issued compulsory licenses. They have not yet begun the generic production of these drugs themselves. Brazil really is leading, and India are in particular leading the way here, and hopefully South Africa will join with them, and we'll see a real new powerful axis in the South in the interests of global public health.
Finally, Mark Ritchie, the timing of the agriculture bill in terms of electoral politics?
Well, normally it would run out in the fall, right before the election. But it's been so universally acknowledged that the previous bill was a disaster. It failed at all levels. Politicians were scrambling to replace it. It came out just in time to affect this year's crop. Obviously, it was aimed at trying to influence the large number of Senate races that are out in the Farm Belt this fall. We'll have to see what effect it has, but it's clearly designed for consumption for this November's elections.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time to talk about this unusual trip. Paul O'Neill, U.S. Treasury Secretary, and Irish rocker Bono guiding him through Africa.
Well, thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sally Booker of Africa Action, Mark Ritchie of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and that does it for the program. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Michael Yeh. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!